Welcome to the latest edition of The Industrialist. My name is Frederik Hammermeister. I'm a managing director with the industrial segment of Accenture. And I'm exceptionally pleased to have with me here today the corporate vice president, manufacturing and mobility at Microsoft, Dominic Wee. Thanks for joining us and welcome.
Frederik, glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Dominic, before we dive right into the topic, how would you describe yourself with just one word?
I probably pick curious. I really like to understand how things work. I think that's why I ended up in manufacturing and mobility. And it's obviously a great time to be curious with so many things happening right now around us.
When we look at our manufacturing clients these days, they are looking at a number of challenges. And then at the same time, there is a lot of emerging new technology which they can employ. Very generally speaking, where do you see manufacturing developing? Are there some interesting trends that you're observing, things that you're expecting, and maybe some not so obvious things that you are seeing in your daily life?
It's really been a very interesting time the past 6 to 12 months. A lot of stuff, I believe, has happened in the larger picture that I guess the few of us have expected, right? And I think in particular the rapid diffusion of generative AI technology, that is probably at a very high level what I would say, you know, what's driving all of this. ChatGPT was launched in the public in November 2022, which is not that long ago. I think at that point in time, exciting, but I don't think anybody would have expected how fast it would take the world by storm. What I find increasingly amazing is the pace at which the technology manages to add tangible value. And I think being through a lot of new technologies, right? And, you know, the Gartner hype cycle and all of these things. And, you know, not all technologies have yielded the same value to the end user as maybe the early imagination was, right? And I think that is what is particularly interesting about generative AI, that early in the cycle, we're already seeing a lot of, you know, real value. If you just pick out a couple of examples. I mean, one that is very visible right now in the world of automotive is that Mercedes, already in June last year, they made ChatGPT in the vehicle available to nearly 1 million customers in the U.S. Then Volkswagen followed up. They made an announcement at CES that they'll be doing something similar in nearly all of their production vehicles. And, you know, the car is a very complex environment, and launching innovation inside the car is usually hard because you only manage to do something in the next product cycle, which is like 5 years out. But because all of this is happening on the back end, right, you can bring it into the vehicle more or less immediately. So I think the scale is amazing. You know, millions of people across these two brands. The fact that it's a car is amazing. A car is quite a difficult application for new technology. And then, you know, this the two combined with the pace of innovation, right? Seeing this happening already in June, you know, just a couple of months after the public introduction of ChatGPT, having the technology available in a vehicle, I think is unusual speed of adoption, right? And we talk about technology fusion, right? The speed at which, you know, new technology reaches its end users and creates value. So I think this is really unusual. To give you another example, we're working with a big industrial company. They make heavy capital goods. They've basically made the technology available internally to thousands and thousands of their employees. And it took them just like maybe 3 months to do this. And now a lot of their employees, they can basically use it as a data science tool. And they can use natural language as a data science tool. Again, a very large company, a very conservative company. So I think these are the kind of examples that we wouldn't have seen with other technologies, and it's the speed, and actually the other aspect here I think is also the breadth of use cases we see. I mean, I think it shows us that it's really a foundational technology, and to me this is also the difference to the previous era of AI, right? I'm sure you've done a lot of business, you know, making AI happen pre-generative AI in industrial environments. And I think what we were doing in the past is, you know, was very specialized. You would build a machine learning model to do quality control on one specific part. And then you would make it work, and then you would try to apply it to another part, and you would need 5,000 pictures, retrain the model on a different part. So it was highly specialized, and the effort required to basically go from one use case to one use case that is very much adjacent was huge, which I think also was obviously why the technology didn't scale very broadly, because the level of specialization and cost of broadening. This is what is really particular about generative AI, is that we have this ability to do a lot of different things with very little incremental effort.
Are you seeing any particular use cases around manufacturing that they are gaining wide adoption? They are basically no regret, and everyone should be evaluating them at least now?
I think it really goes across. One that is most universal, because I think it is most suited to the nature of these large language models, is everything to do with language. And it's, in particular, it's to do with customer sales and service. The obvious one is, you know, call centers, but it's more consumer context, which is probably less, you know, relevant for the audience here. But like, if you have a call center, that's certainly like the number one thing to go after. But I think what we're seeing for companies that are more like in an industrial B2B context, there's an adjacent thing around advising a customer. And this could be pre-sales. So we're talking to some manufacturing companies that make highly specialized products, and they have like 10,000 different SKUs. And the person buying it, you know, might not know what SKU exactly to get. And so you have vacation sales problem, right? And so that is very suited, basically building a digital advisor. And then that context also, I think most industrial companies, they serve a certain amount of their customers through a direct channel, and then they serve a significant amount of their customers through an indirect channel. It basically gives you the ability to strengthen your digital selling and then sell to more customers directly, right? Thereby increasing your margin and also providing a better customer experience, right? So that's a pre-sale piece. But then also after sales, coming back to capital goods, a lot of our customers, you know, that make things like elevators, ATMs, right? Things that get installed somewhere. And then you have a massive field force out there to make sure these things work 24/7, which is a major, you know, piece of their P&L. Improving the quality of that after sales service, starting from the customer feels a call, describes an issue, up to the point where, you know, somebody in the field is trying to repair the thing, basically making the entire knowledge base of the company available in a natural language way to customers with all kinds of backgrounds, languages, and then again in your field force. Many of our customers, you have tens of thousands of people in the field force in more than 100 countries. Enabling these people is a hard task. And, you know, all the language capability that comes kind of built into like a natural language interface can really improve the productivity of your after sales service. That is probably the first cluster I would talk about. The second one where we're seeing incredible demand is everything to do with innovation and product development. Because in a lot of categories that we work with, there's increasing competitive pressure. It's also new competitors from China, they move faster. So there's pressure on innovation speeds. And then also the products in many categories are getting more complex. A lot of products these days have software included, which makes the product more rich and maybe also opens new sources of revenue, but it also actually makes the product development cycle longer, not shorter. And so we have a bunch of customers that come to us basically saying the number one question is, how can I reduce my development time? And I think generative AI provides an entire, you know, set of new answers to the question. The most obvious one is our longest standing generative AI product, which is GitHub Copilot, which basically increases the productivity of developers. So typically around 50% productivity improvements for customers that use it at scale, which is massive. If you have a somewhat significant software development operation ongoing, I think that is, you know, the immediate, you know, like highly established fix by now. But what we're seeing now is, you know, customers looking into how can I extend that power of GitHub Copilot and software development to my entire end-to-end development cycle. And we're seeing application at the very beginning of the cycle, for instance, requirements management, which is something which can be very easily done using generative AI capability, to the very end of the development cycle, which is like regulatory compliance checking. And then, you know, all kinds of things also in the middle. So that's probably the second cluster. And then the third cluster, obviously, on the shop floor. Generative AI, we're seeing a lot of partners working, we're seeing a lot of customers working on. The number one thing is using it to better understand what's happening on the shop floor. Having done a lot of that work myself at the beginning of my career, as I had alluded to initially, if you have a somewhat well-established manufacturing operation, you usually have debugged the easy stuff. And then what it's really about to go from good to great is, you know, when something goes wrong or you're trying to improve something, like to figure out what is actually happening. It's a lot of data science work in a way. And now generative AI basically enables every individual on the shop floor to use data science like an expert. It basically levels up the capability to an unusual level. And we always talk about root cause problem solving. Something went wrong. Why did it go wrong? How do I prevent it from happening again? And very easy. But like need to dig through a lot of data to figure that out. And so I think this is the main innovation we're seeing now on the shop floor. And then lastly, I think in supply chain, obviously a lot of our customers in that space have very complex supply chains. I think we went through the whole COVID set of questions, supply chain visibility and so on. And I think a lot of customers have tackled that to some extent. And now the next horizon of the journey is, again, how can I, bring all the different data sources together? It's a similar approach as the one that I described for the manufacturing shop floor. Can I build a natural language interface to better interact with my supply chain data?
So maybe if we dig a bit more into the third and the fourth use case that you mentioned there, the shop floor and the supply chain. Often with industrial clients, they have for a number of reasons not been able to shift all of their operations and data into the cloud. That could be security concerns, it could be latency, connectivity issues. So naturally, because it's close to the machinery, a lot of the compute and the data is also close to the machinery on the edge, if you want so. Is this in some way a problem or something that limits our ability to deploy generative AI? And how do you see clients dealing with that?
I want to emphasize that we believe in the multi-cloud, hybrid cloud future, right? I think that is the way the technology gets used. And I think any kind of too ideological way of you have to go do this or do this like is bound to kind of fail the reality of most, brownfield environments today. Having said that, I think there's intrinsic reasons why we cannot move data to the cloud, data residency, you talked about latency, right? And then sometimes there's, I think, reasons for not moving the data to the cloud that are more a function of, maybe capability or maturity, right? Also of the cloud technology. And so I think there we've been making big steps forward also on the security side. Number one, one needs to separate one from the other, right, and figure out what I can do. Certainly a lot of the benefits from the cloud, like generative AI, the data has to be there. But again, hybrid cloud is a reality that we work with. And we've just did a big, big update of our entire IoT technology stack, right, with Azure IoT operations. And the fundamental thinking is to basically bring the entire capability of the cloud also to the edge and to also enable you to manage everything very seamlessly in the same way. There's a lot of innovation and ways of making things easier over time.
There is another challenge than many of the, let's say, larger clients especially face, that they have a footprint of factories. And often they are quite diverse because they are producing different products or they are producing different parts of the value chain. You have a lot of M&A history with some of those companies. And so you're not looking at a consistent tech stack, but you're looking at a factory by factory setting. And then the question is often, how do I then scale a use case in the most efficient way? What's your view on
that? It's certainly, a problem we run into more or less every single time. I mean, rarely do you have a customer that has a greenfield environment. Like sometimes you have the privilege of, supporting a customer and building a new, large manufacturing facility from scratch was also a very interesting question. But I think in nearly all of the cases you have, you just have a very heterogeneous footprint. And I think this is also, I think there's another factor in Frederick, that we very often see. Also very often the governance is very decentralized, right? I think a lot of manufacturing companies, opted for giving a lot of power to the factories, right, which is a great thing, but which obviously also makes it harder to drive any innovation, right, from a central point of view. It's a very common problem that, I think we need to deal with all the time. And, beyond the approaches that I described earlier, we're also working with two very wonderful partners, Site Machine and Cognite, who more or less made it their entire mission, right, bringing together the data on the shop floor from a very heterogeneous, and fragmented environment as it is today, and enabling people on the factory shop floor to get more data, more insight from it. One half of the issue is the connectivity. That's usually less the smaller half. More often, the bigger half of the issue is I actually have the data, but I'm trying to make sense of it. This is where, both of these companies are very well equipped, depending on, your specific circumstance, to help you get more value out of your data.
If we kind of zoom out a bit from the shop floor and look a bit more holistic at a company that wants to now embrace this new technology and leverage the benefits that we've been talking about. Do you have a general recommendation of how to go about this and how to be successful with this?
This is a great question, Frederick. Very often the bottleneck to technology adoption is not the technology, right? How do you support your people and your organization to do it? I think the first success pattern we see with our customers as they go on this journey is to actually formalize it somewhere and somehow in their operating model, right? And it can be, you know, in the existing structures and roles, or it can be through setting up something dedicated. Just to give you one example, we are very close with Schneider Electric, both as a customer and as a partner. What they've done already a couple of years ago, they actually appointed a chief AI officer. And by having that chief AI officer, somebody whose mission is it, right, to, you know, drive the diffusion of the technology, and, you know, where also a lot of the competence and decision-making, you know, can be centralized, you know, help them a lot, you know, drive AI momentum. The other thing that I observed recently, as we are kind of now seeing first, like, initial patterns emerging between our customers on, like, speed of adoption of generative AI technology is, it's interesting, I think, people coming from, you know, the business perspective, they tend to start by asking, what is the best use case? And then I think you have the typical way of approaching technology adoption is, let's prioritize the use cases, align resources against it, right? And then we go after the most promising use cases. What I've seen now is there's a bunch of customers that have taken a totally different approach, that have made a lot of progress, which was like, actually, I don't know what the use case is, and I don't care what the use case is. I just make the technology available to as many people as possible, and they will figure it out, right? I've hired a lot of smart people, let them just do their job. And this is a success pattern that we currently see the whole number of customers. And the way I explain this to myself, and this is basically just, you know, what we're seeing, right? The way I make sense of it is that, coming back to what I said before, the technology is so easy to use that it's more like, it's less like the AI of the past. It's more like Excel. Nobody ever asked the question, like, what's the killer use case for Excel, right? Like, it's like, just give it to people and they do something with it, right? And it shows up in all kinds of unexpected places, right? Making, you know, life easier for people. So I think, like, switching that, it's also called AI, but it probably, from a creating value perspective, works different from the way, you know, AI used to work.
Looking ahead a bit, coming up in April, we have a Hanover Fair, and I know Microsoft will have a very big presence there. Can you tell us a bit more about what are the focus areas that Microsoft is going to look at Hanover Fair, and maybe also what are trends that you expect to see when you go there?
I'm guessing we'll still be talking about AI quite a bit. Probably the first thing to say here is that, I mean, yes, Hannover Messe is huge for us as well. I mean, it's the most important event of the year. I'm very much looking forward to it. And, you know, our machinery has been more that's been running since last Hannover Messe, right, to get ready for the next one. I think it's an amazing event, right, to see, like, what state of the art and, you know, talk to customers and partners. The other piece that, you know, Microsoft has always done that I think will also be very prominent again in next upcoming Hannover Messe is, you know, we really operate through our partners. And I think what you can expect to see when you go to the Microsoft booth is that you can expect to see a lot of the great work of all of our partners, including yourself, right? Because this is how, you know, how Microsoft operates, right? We operate through partners, and this is how we bring the value to our end customers.
This has been a great conversation, Dominik. Thank you so much for your time and the insights. And I'm really looking forward to continue this dialogue in Hanover.
Likewise. Very much looking forward. Thank you, Frederick.